This is Digital Story Podcast number 584, May 16th, 2017. Today's theme is The Stupid Things I Do. I'm Derek Story. Photography isn't about getting some of the settings right, it's about nailing all of them. If there are 10 things that you need to do for a great shot and you accomplish only 9, then guess what? You're probably going to be disappointed. I was thinking about this after my latest blunder and realized that there are a handful of mishaps that have plagued me repeatedly. And they are the theme for today's show. So after I had just missed a cool shot, a shot that I really wanted because of one of my classic dumb moves, I turned to my son. We were out on a hike. I turned to my son and I said, "Do you ever do stuff like this?" You see, I have this misguided belief that millennials never make tech mistakes, that they have some sort of chip in their brain that enables them to operate anything with a battery. But instead of saying no, he replied, "Yeah, I do that all the time." And that got me thinking. So maybe I'm not the only 10-thumbed photographer on the planet. So what I thought I'd do this week is share my top 5 bonehead moves and see if you can relate to them. And then if you want, if you have your own personal bonehead favorite, then maybe you could share that on our TDS Facebook page, you know, where we have the digital story. I post the podcast there every week, a link to the podcast. In the comments section, maybe you could post your favorite bonehead move. And then together, we can all sort of realize that, hey, you know what? I'm not the only guy that makes this mistake, okay? So anyway, I have 5 that I seem to do way too often, okay? And here's the first one. I call it stuck in self-timer mode. And this is the one that actually prompted this show. So I was on this hike and I wanted to do a self-timer shot where I got in it. You know, the thing where you put the camera on a rock or a Mifoto tripod or something, and then you put it in self-timer mode and then you rush in and get the shot. I love those. I also use the self-timer for any sort of tripod shot, really, where I want to make sure I don't jar the camera during exposure, especially if it has a longish shutter speed. So I did this self-timer shot. This is during our hike on Saturday. I did this self-timer shot. And then, you know, we're walking along. I see this really beautiful butterfly. We're down in Santa Barbara area. My son goes to University of California, Santa Barbara. So we were down in Santa Barbara area. And I see this really beautiful butterfly on a thistle flower. And I love those shots, and there were butterflies galore this day. But this guy had parked it there, and he seemed like he was going to hang out there for a minute. It was the flower was in the sun. And I go, oh, man. So I get my camera, and I close focus, and I framed it. It was absolutely beautiful shot. And I press the shutter, and nothing happens. And I'm going, what? What? What's going on here? You know, the camera was on. You know, everything seemed fine. I press the shutter again, still nothing happens. So then I look at the camera, and sure enough, I had left it in self-timer mode, right? And it was blink, blink, blink. And then you know how this thing works, right? I've told similar stories like this before because, well, quite frankly, I've done this before. About the time you turn it around and you face the camera towards your face, the thing goes off, right? So instead of taking a picture of a beautiful butterfly on a thistle flower, I took a picture of my stupid face, you know, looking at the camera going, what's wrong here? So then, of course, I take the camera out of self-timer mode, put it back in single shot mode, something I should have done in the first place, right? Right after I took the shot before with the self-timer, and then go back to the flower, turn my attention back to the flower, and of course, the butterfly flies away. And that's the way those stupid self-timer mode things seem to go for me. I lose the shot, I figure out the problem, and then by the time I correct it, I've missed the shot. So very annoying. And so after I did that, and I'm thinking, yeah, wow, how many times have I done this? And that kind of got me thinking about the show. However, the next one is the one that really pushed me over the edge. And this is the one that I asked Zach about. So I also carry my iPhone on these hikes because I'm bringing a film camera. And I use the iPhone shots when I take a film camera shot to record all the metadata, you know, where we are, the geotags, and all the other stuff. And I put it in a diary, and I keep that in sync with the film shot so that I always know when I take a film shot, all the particulars that go with it. Works great, okay? But it was a very bright day. So there we are, very bright day. And I go to take this iPhone shot, and I'm having a little hard time seeing the screen because that's what happens in very bright light. You really can't see all the details. And what I had done when I swiped to the screen is that I overswiped. So I went from photo mode in the iPhone to video mode. Oh, I hate this. Oh, gosh, I hate this. I do this one a lot. I think this is a real UI problem. I don't think this is just me being a bonehead, in all honesty. This happens to me a lot. So what happened was when I went to swipe, because what I do is I use the swipe mode to get to the camera, and then I overswipe, and I move it from photo mode into video mode. And sometimes if I do it really poorly, I move it from photo mode into slow-mo mode. So then not only do I get to see, you know, some sort of horrible video of the ground and the sky swirling around and my shoes and all that kind of stuff, I get to see it in slow motion, which is even better, right? More salt in the wound. So at any rate, I had done this. So I overswiped, and here I go to take the shot, and it was, you know, kind of a timely shot again. I don't hear a click or anything, and I'm looking at it, and I was recording a video. So overswipe to video with the iPhone. This is super annoying to me, and this is something that I probably do more than anything else. And this is what I asked Zach. I said, Zach, do you ever do this? This is really annoying to me when I do this, where, you know, I do what I just described to you. And he actually says that he does it too. So that made me feel slightly better. And I don't think he was just humoring his dad. I think he was actually like, yeah, I do that too. It's very annoying. So overswipe the video. That is my second very annoying thing that I seem to do over and over again. All right, next one. High ISO landscapes. That's what I call this one. So if you want to have your landscapes look like something NASA has just sent back from Mars, then go ahead and leave your ISO at 6400. But if you don't like that lovely, grainy, desaturated look, then you might want to ratchet it down a few notches. When does this happen? Well, this is kind of like the self-timer thing. So I take it off auto ISO because I have a specific thing I want to do. I want to shoot in low light. I want to have a certain aperture, all that kind of stuff. I want to take control of my camera, which is a very dangerous thing I've discovered. I want to take control of my camera. So then I just lock it down at ISO 3200, lock it down at ISO 6400, do my thing. That way I get the aperture and the shutter speed that I want, complete control. But then, guess what? Sometimes I forget to take it out of that because my default mode is auto ISO. And auto ISO is very safe. That's why I'm supposed to put it back into auto ISO after I do a shoot where I've locked it down. Sometimes I forget. So then, of course, the next shot that I take with that camera happens to be, oh, let's say the next morning. It's beautiful outside, gorgeous sunrise. The light is just perfect. It's streaming in. It's golden warm. I go, yes, I'm going to grab this shot right now. Pick up my camera, frame it. Not really paying attention to the really fast shutter speed and the closed down aperture because it's a quick shot. I just see it. I go to grab it. And of course, because it's at ISO 6400, it's not nearly as beautiful as it could be. So that is my number three, which I call high ISO landscapes, where I forget to bring it back to auto ISO after I've done a high ISO shot, usually the night before. Next one, number four, rangefinder lens cap left on. Now, those of you that shoot with rangefinder cameras, you're going to be able to relate to this. So what makes a rangefinder different is that you're not looking through the same lens that you're taking the picture. So you're looking through a separate lens. And then the lens that's taking the pictures goes, you know, directly to the shutter and all that kind of stuff. It's fine. I love it. I love shooting with rangefinders. I think they're cool. I like the way the cameras look, all that kind of stuff. They're usually a bit more compact. They're lovely, lovely cameras. And this is mainly film, you know, that I'm shooting with rangefinders. Because now, with mirrorless rangefinders, we still get to look through the lens most of the time. Most mirrorless. Not all of them, but most of them. However, when I'm shooting with film, it's not the case. And I've told this story before. This actually happened to me in Austin. And I was just learning how to shoot with a Contax G1, which is a terrific rangefinder camera. And I was doing this low-light shoot inside this cool bar in Austin, Texas. Put it on my little mini tripod, and I'm running the self-timer. And, you know, I line it up. I'm looking through the viewfinder. I line it up. Everything's looking great. And I use a self-timer, another dangerous move. And I click the shutter, and self-timer finally goes off 10 seconds later. And the shutter just stays open, and it stays open, and it stays open. And I'm going, wow. This is a really long exposure. And about that time, Steve Huff walks by. He has his own website. He's very popular, very nice guy, very big name. I kind of wanted to get to know him a little bit better on this trip. He walks by, and he just looks at me, and I probably look a little flustered. And he's going, your lens cap's on. And, you know, sometimes you always want to have a good comeback for stuff like this. And the only comeback I could come up with was, well, that explains the long shutter, doesn't it? Yeah, not exactly quick on the draw there. Yes, and I have done that more than once where I left the lens cap on when I go to take a picture with a rangefinder camera. So this probably doesn't happen to as many of you because there's not as many film shooters out there and film shooters shooting rangefinder cameras. Those of you who do, you know what I'm talking about. And Steve Huff and I will probably never be buds because I'm sure he considers me intellectually inferior. And finally, this is also one of my favorites. This is number 5. It's what I call the backup dead battery. And my famous story on this, I have done this a number of times. And what is this I'm talking about? This is where I always make sure I have a spare battery with me because I'm a very thorough and together photographer. However, there have been times when that extra battery I had with me was dead and not charged because I got them mixed up. Yes, I've actually done this. And my favorite one of this, still, I was in Washington, D.C. My first visit to the Lincoln Memorial, the Lincoln Monument there. And it was a great morning. I was there with my camera. I had a spare battery and I had a spare card in my pocket. The light was really great. And I was running low on battery, but I wasn't worried because I knew I had an extra battery. So I'm, you know, working the shots and shooting President Lincoln, doing all this stuff, getting these great shots. And the battery finally runs out on the one that's in my camera. And I'm not worried at all. In fact, I'm with great swagger, I pull the battery out of the camera and I nonchalantly reach into my pocket and I pull out the other battery and put it in the camera and fire it up. And you know, batteries, they recharge slightly when they're dead and they've been sitting for a bit. So the lens did come back out and I'm ready to shoot again. I take one frame and the battery icon starts flashing. And I go, what? This can't be. By the time I sort of parsed what was going on, the lens collapsed back into the camera and the camera shuts down. I mean, I had no juice left in that battery. So there I was with President Lincoln on a beautiful morning, way far away from my hotel room, many, many, many blocks away, long Washington, D.C. blocks away, with absolutely no juice at all, when I thought I had it covered. And I have done this more than once where my backup battery was actually a dead battery. So those are the 5 things that have plagued me most often. And every one of them drives me crazy. And as I said, even this last weekend, 2 of them happened to me. 2 of them happened to me the stuck in self timer mode and the overswipe to video both happened to me this weekend. So obviously, I'm not upping my game very much. So if you have one of these things, like I mentioned at the top of this bit, if you have one of these things that just drives you crazy, if you would go to our Facebook page, it's facebook.com/thedigitalstory. I'll post the podcast on there, and then you can comment. And if you would share your favorite one of these mishaps as a comment, I think we'd all get a kick out of it. I think we'd all feel, well, just a little bit better. The practical benefits of high-speed sync, often referred to as HSS. So I don't know how familiar you are with HSS, but it's certainly worth talking about. And most of our cameras can do this. This is kind of the neat thing about it. This is a functionality that a lot of us have. You know, if we have Canon or Nikon, and we have Canon or Nikon flash, I know Fujifilm has added this recently to their cameras. So what is this and why would you want it? Well, generally speaking, our cameras top out for sync speed, and I mean, you know, where we can take a picture with the flash at around 1/250th of a second or slower, sometimes slower, but 1/250th is about the highest that you'll see on mostly cameras that we use for flash synchronization. And this is fine for indoor work and low light work and things like that. However, there are times when it'd be nice to use flash with a higher shutter speed. Let's say that it's an action shot. And, you know, the classic, you know, someone doing a skateboard jump or something like that. So you want to bring a little light in, control the light on the subject. You want to balance it with the ambient light. And, of course, you know, you want to freeze the action. And so you can't do that at 1/125th or 1/250th. You need to get up around 1/1000th of a second, 2/1000th of a second, something like that. Well, that's where HSS comes in, high-speed sync. It allows you to use the flash at a much higher shutter speed so you can freeze action. Now, another scenario, and this is one that's more common to my needs, which is I want to do a portrait outdoors. I want to bring in some light from a flash. I want to balance it with the ambient light. But I want to have a fast shutter speed so I can use a super wide aperture. I want to shoot it at f1.8 or f2 or even f1.4, depending on what lens I have. Well, outdoors in late afternoon light, you're going to need probably shutter speed faster than 1/250th in order to accomplish a very wide aperture. And again, this is where high-speed sync comes in. So if I can shoot at 1/2000th of a second or 1/4000th of a second, get that super wide aperture, bring in a little light from the flash, then I can really create something that looks great. And this is particularly handy if you want the subject to be doing something. Like, for instance, let's say that I'm shooting a female model and there's a little bit of breeze and the hair's kind of blowing up, and I want to freeze the hair when it's kind of doing this neat blow up thing, you know, where it's kind of whoo like that. Well, again, I can't do that at 1/125th of a second. So high speed comes in handy. Now, the way this works is that instead of just doing one flash, what your flash does, it pulses. So instead of firing the flash at the start of the shot, like normally happens, or if you're doing a second curtain at the end of the shot, instead of just doing one flash, HSS pulses the flash throughout the whole exposure. And by doing so, it simulates the effects of continuous light. So it's very nice. It's a great technique. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this up this week is because the other thing that you want to do is you want to be able to measure this light, and especially if you're using multiple flashes, which you often have to do with HSS, because there are a couple compromises from using high-speed flash. One is that the output range really isn't as far as with a single shot. And you can imagine why, right? It's things pulsing, so it's not going to be able to put out as much light with each pulse. You're not going to have as much light coming off your flash. So a lot of times in these situations, photographers will use more than one flash for HSS. So you have multiple flashes going, or one flash with that's closer to the subject, and then you have the ambient light, and you want to make this all work. And you don't want to spend hours trying to do a lot of trial and error. So this is where a handheld light meter comes in. And that's the reason why I'm bringing it up, because of the Saucony Speedmaster, the L858D handheld light meter. This current model, one of the things that it can do is that it can measure flash output in this particular setting. So it can measure HSS. In fact, what they say is, this is what Saucony says, the L858DU, you don't really have to remember the model number because the link is in the show notes, okay? Anyway, it's the first meter of its kind that can measure the stroboscopic pulses fired from strobes when they are used for high-speed sync. Finally, photographers now have an accurate way of measuring their lights when they want to overpower the sun or achieve a very shallow depth of field through using HSS. This answers the question that I asked last week. This is another answer to the question I asked last week. When we already have these great light meters in our cameras, why would we want to use a handheld meter? Why would we want to spend the extra money for a handheld meter? And we talked about reflected versus incident light last week, which is definitely one of the situations. But if you want to do HSS, and, you know, here's the thing. These are somewhat complicated shoots. You're going to burn up your trial and error just getting all the other parts right. In other words, if we're talking about a breeze with hair, you're going to burn up your trial and error just getting that one frame that you like. Or if we're talking about skateboarder jumping, how many times are you going to have a skateboarder jump just so you can figure out the ratio between your flash output and the ambient light? You know, the guy is going to be tired by the time you're ready to do the regular shot. So this is when, you know, having a Saucony Speedmaster light meter can really help you, because what you do then is you get everything set up, you get it all locked in, you use the light meter to measure the flash output and the ambient light. It helps calculate for you the exact shutter speed and aperture that you need to be using with the ISO. And then when you start shooting, then you're actually shooting and you're not going to tire your model, you're not going to tire your skateboarder or whomever. And hopefully you will get the shot that you want before everyone runs out of juice, including your flashes, right? So this is a situation where a handheld light meter is just invaluable. So if you want to learn more about the Saucony Speedmaster L858DU handheld light meter, just go ahead and click on the link in the show notes. It talks about HSS, it talks about incident versus reflected light, talks about all this sort of stuff, and you can really learn more about this incredible device that will help you get these professional-looking shots that you just can't get with the meter that's built into your camera. In the news, federal jury awards $900,000 to plant retailer in photo theft lawsuit. So this is a story I saw on Petapixel, and I'll go ahead and read the story to you. But one thing really jumped out at me when I read this story, and this is something that I've seen a lot, and that's what I want to talk about for a minute after I read this story. But first, listen to this story, because it's very interesting. $900,000 is a lot of money. Petapixel reports, an Oregon-based plant retailer was just awarded almost $1 million in actual damages by a federal jury in one of the biggest photography copyright wins of the year so far. Despite the strange circumstances of the case, it's being called a huge win for artists, photographer, and creators. I love it when I'm reading someone else's copy and there's a typo in it, and I just go ahead and read the typo. A huge win for artists, photographers, and creators. According to PDN, the case revolves around the unauthorized use of 24 copyrighted images captured by Under a Foot Plant Company, President Francis White, for use in marketing a product they came up with called Steppables. Basically, plants that can be walked on. And there's another typo there. Basically, plants that can be walked on. White and company were able to show in court that a competing company, Maryland-based Exterior Design, used 24 of White's images and marketing materials ranging from web pages to posters to brochures for their own Treadwell plants, infringing on White's copyright a total of 133 times from 2011 until the suit was filed in 2014. Now here's the part that gets me. Despite several cease and desist requests sent between 2011 and 2014, Exterior Design continued using the photographs, leaving White no choice but to sue for unauthorized use of photos, unfair competition, and unjust enrichment. Exterior Design denied all claims, but a federal jury in Maryland ultimately sided with Under a Foot, awarding the company either $900,000 in actual damages or $300,000 in statutory damages. It's fair to say the plaintiff will probably pick the former. These photographs were the result of countless hours of time, attention, planning, and preparation, White said in a statement. This was a huge win for artists, photographers, and creators. So the part that gets me about this, and this is something that I have seen before, is that once the offending party is caught, and they're contacted by the party that's being damaged, they continue to do their thing. They blow them off and they ignore them, or they just say, you know, what are you going to do kind of thing. And they force the party that's being damaged to actually bring the suit to court. And that just blows my mind, because it seems to me that if you get caught doing something such as using someone else's photographs for commercial purposes without authorization, you get caught, you go, wow, I'm really sorry, I'm going to stop right now. Because most of the time, if you stop right now, that's where it ends. That's where it ends. And, you know, you say you're sorry, and you move on, and hopefully they'll let you move on. But time after time again, people don't do this, and I do not understand this. A lot of times when I find people using my shots without authorization, they're not horrible offenses, and I don't lose much sleep about it. But if I ever did find someone that was using it for commercial purposes, and I contacted them, and I gave them a cease and desist, and they blew me off, that would irritate me, I have to say, and then I would really pursue them. And in this case, I'm glad the photographer won the suit, because, you know what? The guy blew him off, and I think he got what he deserved. Just a few updates and such. Big thanks to all of our Patreon members. And I tell you, all of you guys and gals who are supporting the site month in and month out, keeping it online, allowing me to be picky about the sponsors that we choose, and just, I think, overall, allowing me to provide a better listening experience for everyone. Thank you so much for your patronage. Thank you for being a member of our inner circle. It means a lot to me. Also, I want to mention that registration invitations are out to the Autumn and Wine Country reserve list, folks. And I'm probably going to limit it to reserve lists for one more week, and then I'm going to start talking about it publicly. We're half full right now from the reserve list. If you're thinking about going to this workshop, which is going to be tremendous, it's in October. Here in Wine Country, we're going to do beautiful landscape photography. We're going to have tours. We're going to do wine tasting. You're really going to get to see some of the finest spots in Sonoma County in terms of viticulture. If you're interested in this sort of thing, and if you'd like to bring along a travel mate, the way that we're setting up this workshop is that travel mates can participate in half the workshop. It's really cool. The wine tasting, a few of the walks, some of the meals. It's really fun. If you're interested, before I open it up to the public, go ahead and go over to our workshops page. Use the Send Me Info form, and I'll get the reserve link in your hands. And finally, a big thanks to our friends at Red River Paper for sponsoring this podcast, for sponsoring this site, for getting me out to Chicago in June, coming up next month, out of Chicago next month, for helping me produce the ebook that I'm working on. Red River Paper, they make fantastic inkjet printing paper. They make it at a reasonable price. That's because they make the paper and they sell the paper. We have a tile on all the pages of the digital story. You can go there, go to our landing page, look at the special offer, and then browse from there. They have tutorials, They have great supplies. You can buy your ink there. Really, anything related to printing that you may want to do artistically is probably on that site. Red River Paper, and they also have a terrific Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. That's going to do it for me this week. Now that I've got that out of my system, in terms of my blunders, we'll move on to new topics next week. I hope you come back and join me. We're having the Northern California Coast Workshop starting on Thursday this week. I've got a great crew. I'm going out and doing a little bit more scouting tomorrow, actually. And then I'm going to be ready for everyone coming into town on Thursday. I'll talk a little bit about that next week, but we're going to some fantastic places. And I'll share the highlights with you. Until then, have a great week. I'll talk to you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.